any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy award-winning app that instantly transfers your notes into new drafts in seconds. Scriptation allows you to digitally mark up scripts, separate notes into layers, track changes across revisions, and so much more. Insert Noah saying something nice about Scriptation.
Dan, I think this is where they actually want me to talk about how much I love it. And I do love it. It's great. Its collating function transformed me from the messiest writer in Hollywood to, well, ever so slightly less messy. My wife might have other things to say about that. Scriptation listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Scriptation.
For those of you who don't understand slightly drawly American accents, that's scriptation.com/S-I-T-H-A.
Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein.
And I am your still-in-the-entertainment-business co-host, Noah Evslin. For this week's podcast, I'm thrilled to introduce Eddie Schmidt to the show. Eddie is an Oscar and Emmy-nominated producer, director, and showrunner. Eddie produced six projects that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival: Chelsea Does for Netflix, which he directed; Valentine Road, nominated for 2 Emmy Awards; Twist of Faith, nominated for an Academy Award; and Chain Camera, all for HBO. As well as This Film Is Not Yet Rated for IFC and Troubadours, which aired as part of an Emmy-winning season of PBS's American Masters. On top of many other industry credits, Eddie is currently the executive producer and showrunner and director of Peacock's comedy special, Good One, a show about jokes featuring Mike Birbiglia. Welcome, Eddie.
Thanks for having me.
I think that's a new record for the longest bio. So I guess the obvious place to start is it was going on so long, I was sort of falling asleep a bit, which is no disrespect to you. It's more Noah's voice, but I kept hearing Academy Award. I kept hearing Emmy. So all these things you're nominated for, all this success, what sounds like a large number of credits, why are you on a show about rejection and failure?
Well, notice it said nominated. I didn't win. So there you go.
Obviously, you know, you've got a good list of credits. You've obviously had a very successful career. Do you feel, you know, you've got a new show coming out, you're the showrunner and the director. Have you achieved career success, do you think? Or are you, like all the writers we've had on before, still you don't feel it's a success yet?
Yeah, I don't know if you ever do, if you're a creative person innately, right? So you're always striving for more. I think I've had some successes, but I wouldn't say, oh, I'm just, you know, coasting down Easy Street. I think, first of all, this industry is in constant upheaval, right? So it's always changing and you try to change with it, but there's a certain thing that you do. I like to think I work in a few lanes, but I'm always looking to tell another story or to do something I haven't done, right? Let's say to direct a scripted series or to nominated for an Academy Award, gee, I'd like to win one someday. So I think there's always, you know, there's always something more. And even then, I suppose maybe I would achieve those things and still feel like, well, I'm not really a success, you know, fully a success.
Is it getting easier now that you're a name and you can walk into a room and people will listen to you? Like, is it actually getting easier to do this, or does it not get easier?
Well, I think what gets easier, certainly the ability to get meetings, the ability to pitch, the ability to connect with people and to point to past things that they would hopefully know that had some resonance in the culture, that is very helpful, obviously. And I think, again, you know, you mentioned some of the films in the intro, and I've done some television series and as well. And I think because I have eclectic interests, I've been fortunate to indulge them, right? So I've made things that yes, there are some true crime. There's some that's food travel. There's some that's music, comedy, so on and so forth. And so what that has made easier is that because that's genuine reflection of my own tastes, I can always point to something behind me and say, oh, well, this new one is a little bit like that, or it draws upon something in this world, and people then therefore give it a little more credibility, because as with anything else, you know, risk-taking is done very calculatedly in this industry. So it seems like less of a risk if I can say, oh, yes, I've worked in this genre before or with this kind of material.
That's fascinating. No, obviously, it feels like with you, for some reason, we've done a lot of these interviews, but for you, it feels like we're coming in at the end, not the end of your story, but at the peak of your story. Besides, you know, of course, you not having won an Academy Award yet, but you had a ton of credits and you have a ton of successes. But I want to back up a little bit and try to go in chronological order. So we have young Eddie Schmidt hitting the town. I'm not sure if the town is New York or LA, some town somewhere, with a dream. And is the dream to be a director? Is it to be a writer? Is it to be a showrunner? What was your dream, and how did you get into the unscripted side of things?
Well, I was in bands all through high school, and I sang and played the guitar. So I originally really thought I would get into music. And then I went to college. I went to Vassar College on the East Coast, and I was in a comedy troupe, and I did a lot of acting. I had done some other acting, like in regional, you know, theater as a little kid. And I did really enjoy it. And I always felt that I lit up on stage, felt really comfortable on stage. And I did a lot of acting at Vassar, and did, you know, David Mamet plays and Chekhov and all this stuff. So between that and comedy, I thought, okay, well, you know, I think I could be, you know, a writer, actor, and maybe if I'm lucky, I'll get to direct. And so I came out here being Los Angeles after graduation with a number of other people that were in the this comedy troupe with me. And we started performing in clubs and trying to make a name for ourselves. And that was really hard. and then in the meantime, though, I got a day job in the industry. I did a few jobs for free, because that's when you have no experience, you can work for free. I was a PA, an independent film called Floundering, and I got to be in the end credits, which was fun, standing next to John Cusack. And then I worked in the editing room. And basically, I ended up getting a day job at New Line Cinema, working for post-production supervisors. And I learned a lot about post-production, some of which, you know, I knew from school, but to, you know, this was a whole other level, obviously. And actually, the first thing, my first rung in was, they were still shooting on film, they would have short ends, you know, the leftovers of film. So we had like the leftovers from Dumb and Dumber, or, you know, David Fincher 7, just sitting around. And so a buddy that worked in production, I worked in post, and we sort of rallied around in a very, like, let's put on a show kind of way, and wrote and directed these shorts in the mid 90s and took them to festivals. And so I thought I was on this whole narrative track as a writer director, and then potentially doing comedy, and none of that came to pass. Long story short, we started making a name for ourselves in sketch comedy, and had a deal with Fox TV Studios. We had a sort of coffee table book about the middle finger called The Finger, A Comprehensive Guide to Flipping Off, that was sort of our humor in book form. And we started to get a name for ourselves. And it didn't happen. You know, we were not poised to be the replacement for Mad TV, as they sort of touted us to be. And because I had this background in post-production, I was post-production supervisor on a documentary that Kirby Dick directed. And Kirby Dick asked me if I wanted to produce something with him. And that brought a whole other track, which was to make documentaries. So I sort of, you know, leapt from one horse onto the other. And I thought, okay, well, this horse has legs.
Was there ever a desire? I want to drill down a little bit on that pivot, because I think a lot of people in this town, I don't think a lot of people come into the town saying, I'm going to be a high level development executive. I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that. They come in with a dream, and that dream has them go on a path that they didn't fully expect. And then they find that they're actually really happy doing this, much more happy maybe than they were with the original dream. So you pivot. I love the idea that you're using the ends of the film to make shorts. That's such a cool detail. But you're making things, you guys feel like you're almost there. You have some kind of a name for yourself, but it's not turning into anything lucrative. So what is that moment like when you fully commit to this new career path? Was there like having to like tell your parents you're pivoting, or was it more like, no, this is kind of exciting and it's a shiny star that I want to now grab?
Yeah, I think some of my resilience has come from being a practical minded dreamer. So I think when, you know, you're in your 20s, your overhead is low and you can, you know, sort of figure it out, right? And so I think I was sort of scraping it together, and I was figuring like, well, we're doing these comedy shows and we're getting a name, and we've got now this deal. And then you know, you get an agent and they start waving dollar signs in front of your eyes, and you think, okay, I've got this path. And so, but I never gave up on other things, right? So I was still working as both a post-production supervisor to make money, and working on the side to produce this documentary, which wound up being this film called Chain Camera that got into Sundance in 2001. So when we did not get our TV deal as a comedy troupe in 2000, and I watched some of my, troupe members go on to get jobs as comedy writers on other shows, and I didn't get one, I thought, wow, you know, I've failed, right? Then this documentary got into Sundance, and I was like, well, this is the biggest thing that I've done. And I put, you know, 2 years of my life into it, and we weren't really getting paid. It was a negative pickup. So we had just enough money to make the film. But I thought, this is it. Like, this is a path that I should be going down and that I was excited about. I think part of the transition was also that I really enjoyed sketch and improv. One of the things that we did was to go out into the world in character. This was sort of, you know, kind of before probably the same mindset of the zeitgeist as Sacha Baron Cohen, but before he was on these shores. So we were, you know, you had to sort of act in character in the real world and film them much like a documentary, even though you're playing a character. So the making real documentaries wasn't that much of a stretch. And some of the same thought of trying to capture something real and trying to capture something visually all translated. So I wanted to tell stories, and I felt like, okay, well, this is how I'm going to be able to tell stories. And the other thing about documentaries is that you can pick up a camera and just start. You know, it gets harder as you need to really make a living to your 30s and you want to have a house or a family. But when you're in your 20s, you can take some risks. And so I think that idea of like, oh, I might not have to wait for permission to tell stories in a documentary realm, well, that appealed to me. So I ran with it.
Do you stay in touch with your comedy troupe and compare notes on who's still trying to do improv comedy and who's now getting nominated for Emmys?
Yeah, actually, because we were all college buddies, right? So, you know, what's been really nice is that everybody's gotten to do really interesting things. You know, one of the guys was, I don't remember what his title was, but he's basically, you know, one of the people running Warner Archive for a long time. So preserving old films and re-releasing all these films. And he was a talented graphic designer. He had designed our book about the finger. So it made perfect sense for him. And he was great because he loved pop culture and he could champion these things. And as a matter of fact, he produced a panel at Comic-Con then that I did with Leonard Maltin many years later. Another guy who was, I think, the most charismatic and dynamic of us as a performer went on to, you know, act in shows and write for, he wrote for big, you know, MTV Comedy Awards and, or sorry, MTV Music Awards and things like that. But he also appeared on Sarah Silverman's show and he was Zach Galifianakis' sidekick on his Live at the Purple Onion DVD. And a lot of comedy people, you know, knew him and loved him. So he, you know, one of the other guys became a very successful editor and producer, also in Unscripted, and doing a number of things like Ace of Cakes and things like that. So I think we all went on to do interesting and different things. But the idea of like getting back together and going out and trying to mess with people on the street, you know, that gets a little harder as you age. You sort of age out of the ability to do that ungracefully.
Yeah, no, indeed. So look, comedy's an interesting one. I mean, the lazy question is sort of asking about cancel culture and how it's changed. So I don't want to ask that one, but I'm interested in the sort of the other way comedy has changed. Because obviously, I'm not sure when back in the day was, but, you know, there was stand-up comedy in a room, normally a smoke-filled one probably. But with the advent of streaming, but also with the way social media have changed, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of these comedy specials appearing on the likes of Netflix now, but then there's also, you know, comedians who are, and some of it's pandemic related, where they were just sort of filming themselves at home and so on. Obviously, you're still working comedy. How is it easier to do comedy now because there's so many different outlets, or is it harder because there's so many different outlets that finding your unique voice is now trickier?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both, right? Because I think there are potentially more outlets, but there are more voices. So I think you have to be distinct, but distinct is speaking to your own experience or very much to your end or very much to your own taste, you know? So I think in Good One, in our show, we're following the process of Mike Birbiglia, who, as he says in the show, is an autobiographical comedian. And so his process is personal and he's drawing from his life and it intertwines. In other words, where the material is coming from and sort of even the handmade quality of how he crafts. And then I think of other comedians. I went to see Kate Berlant live. She did an incredible live show that Bo Burnham directed, another talented comedian. And it was so visually arresting and sort of multimedia and on many meta levels, right, of smart. And you sort of think, oh, this is, it's not personal. It's so theatrical. It's so, but because of its incisive quality of the humor and the fact that there's so much to it, it actually is quite personal and revealing in its own way. And so I think there are more ways for comedians to stand out, but the bar is very high, right? I think there was probably more of a time when we had this sort of just, you know, stand in front of a brick wall, evening at the Improv kind of thing, and people were doing material maybe that was not as personal or not as original necessarily. And so now I think it just means that if you are drawn to that, you really want to have something to say and probably also a very special way of saying it, you know? Yeah.
So this is definitely a lazy question, unfortunately, but just because of where you sort of sit in comedy, I'm interested in this for your answer. How are you in terms of consuming comedy? Like, can you actually laugh at stuff, or are you deconstructing the joke? Or when, actually in this show, when like Mike does something that we're going to watch it and think that's funny, are you like, I'm not going to laugh, but I can see why somebody else would laugh at it?
No. I'm a good laugher. I'm not one of those people that's like funny. Sometimes it's like a jousting competition with comedians to validate things as funny and not laugh. I guess that's the thing is, I don't really think of myself as a comedian. I think of myself as comedy adjacent, so it's like, I love it. I appreciate it. I have, made it. I think one of the things that I did actually that was in between sort of the documentary and the sketch in transition to earn a living, I was hired to write the bubbles on Blind Date. So I wrote the joke, those joke bubbles. So I was like, okay, and I've written for other comics for various specials. So I feel like, okay, I love being around comedy people. And I think for me, in transitioning really fully behind the camera, I love bringing out the best in them, bringing out what I think is funny in them, so funny about them. So in working with Chelsea Handler, I just thought she's so quick-witted and so sharp, in that format that she had on a studio set. And I just thought, well, the idea that she wants to go out into the world and meet people in the, in the real world, come out from behind the desk, I just thought, well, that's really delicious because I could tell in 10 minutes of meeting her how sort of sharp and observant she was. And I thought, well, that's just going to be magic. And similarly with Mike Birbiglia, I really appreciated him as a comic voice, I think, in terms of his background, the things that he writes about, the genuineness that with which he presents himself. And so I thought, oh, well, he's already someone who's open to process. So if he's willing to let us in, and it was a lot for him to trust us because he's used to telling his own story, but he did. And I thought, oh, well, this is just delightful. People are going to love him even more. They're literally going to see the joke. They're going to see how he's creating the jokes, and they're going to see the life and the people around him from which the jokes come. Well, this is wonderful. If you're someone like myself who's predisposed to this, you're just going to get even more out of it. You're going to want to see more of Mike, and you're going to really think, I really know where he's coming from. I could really relate to him even better because I have a sense of the whole person and the work involved.
I think you partially answered this next question in this last answer, but it really made me think because you mentioned that you're comedy adjacent, correct? So it's like, but you started out not comedy adjacent. You started out in a sketch comedy group, and the dream was to have your own, Kids in the Hall or whatever type sketch comedy on the air, be the face, because you said you really enjoyed acting. So what happens now? I noticed that obviously it's no coincidence you're working with people like Mike Birbiglia or Chelsea Handler. You understand comedy, and now you're sort of on the other side of the camera helping manage and produce comedians' specials. Is there any ever like pangs of jealousy of like a what if my career went slightly different and I was on that stage? Or have you sort of made peace with your role as the person who executes other people's comedic visions at this point?
I think I've made peace with it because, when I look back, I don't think that I was really probably emotionally developed enough to have handled it. I think it really, if we were to have really been in the spotlight, I think sort of, that level of potential rejection or what have you, I don't sort of look back and think, oh, I should be still doing that. I think, oh, I think I'm a great collaborator. I think I can, again, help bring out what's special about somebody because I'm enjoying them. And I think it's kind of a great role for me to be able to be in the mix and sort of able to, I guess, translate these skills that I have to tell stories in a nonfiction context with a funny person or put a funny person in, whether it's them in going into a world or whether it is literally their process as it is in Good One. I guess I feel like, oh, this is a sweet spot. Like I found a way to take these, two mints into one, and I don't sort of regret that I'm not like the delicious piece of chocolate. I think it's okay.
That's fascinating. Thank you for that answer. And that's also kind of made me think of Dan normally asks the management questions in this partnership. He runs a soccer club. I'm in the industry, so I tend to ask industry related questions. This is sort of both management and industry, but it's fascinating to me is that you are the you wear many hats when you make these, you know, you said you're the director, you're the showrunner, and you're the executive producer. Obviously, executive producer and showrunner are sort of synonymous in this sense, but for those, you know, that's you're the boss. You are managing these productions. And yet you manage for, you know, for a few of them, you've had really big names whose name is actually the name of the product. So Mike Birbiglia, Chelsea Handler, they're on that. So how does that relationship work with you are the showrunner, which is the boss of the production and the people working on the production, and then you have a star who is so connected to the material, and obviously you have to work copacetically, or it's not going to work. So talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, those two examples are slightly different, I guess, but I think I could put them under one umbrella, which is to say, and this is a word I used a little earlier, which was trust, right? Which is to say, comedians, I think, especially, and I've worked, obviously, with other talent, you know, whether it's chef, I worked with David Chang, we did the show Ugly Delicious, or I worked with Zachary Quinto on the reboot of In Search Of. He's a very funny guy, but he's, you know, a serious actor. And this was him hosting in a nonfiction context. But I guess in all of these cases, it's really about making somebody feel comfortable, right? Which is to say, I get you, I appreciate you, I want to make you score. Essentially, which is like, I'm not there to make the star of a show, because that's your hero. That's the hero of your story. That your star, you know, that's a star is a real life special effect. People want to watch dynamic people in front of the camera. So I want them to do well. And I also want them to feel like there's a net, there's support around them. And if something I want them to take risks, right? I want them to open up. I want them to maybe do things that don't feel comfortable if I passionately believe in them, but I also don't want to set them up to fail. It's not a gotcha. We're not making things at their expense. I'm really trying to tell their stories, or trying to capture their perspective inside of an ongoing story in the real world. So I guess that's what it is. And I, you know, comedians more than anybody have just a really strong BS detector, right? So I think what I've found is a lot of people who are very funny and really talented are used to people not telling them the truth. just telling them what they want to hear. And so I think that there comes a lot of strength in not being unbending, obviously, you know, you being a collaborator, but if you really believe in, like, I really think we should do this, or I don't think this worked, or I think we could try it again because I think it could be stronger. You know, they want that. I think they want real feedback. And they want a real collaborator. Most talented people, especially funny people, don't want somebody around who's just going to yes them.
This feels, I wouldn't say this one's a lazy question, but it feels like a sort of obvious question. But if I was working on your show, the last one, with Mike and you, in whatever the job is, some reasonably medium to junior job, would it have been a fun experience to be, obviously it's a comedy show at the end, but actually making it, would it have been fun? And when you as showrunner sort of set the tone for the production right at the beginning, when you have your first meeting, when you talk about what you're going to do, is having fun while making an excellent product actually sort of part of making a comedy show? And do you set it up that way?
I'd like to think I do. I mean, I think there are people that in this industry that lead with fear. I don't think that's a great way to work. I've worked for some people who I think try to lead with fear. It's unpleasant. I try to lead by inspiration. I like to get people excited about what we're going to do, whether it's a cinematographer, editor, my producers, anybody who's part of it. I hope that they're jazzed about what we're making, the kind of thing we're making. It can be hard sometimes if people are on board and they don't. But I think if you foster an environment, particularly the people that are on the set, let's say, because that's your team that is there to make the talent comfortable and to also make it so that you get the good stuff. Because if you're stressed out, you really don't. It's almost like you're putting a filter in front of you if you have to kind of punch through the stress to get to the good stuff. So I think one of the great compliments, actually, that Mike Birbiglia had for me was, I love this crew. I love your crew. This is a great crew. And and that made me feel really good, because if he didn't feel that way, well, he wouldn't feel comfortable. He wouldn't feel comfortable getting mic'd up. He wouldn't feel comfortable with the DP or camera ops, inches from his face. He wouldn't feel comfortable just having to spend time with us. And I think, I can think of other shows where key crew members went on to become really good friends with the talent and continue to have relationships with them or work with them again and again. And that makes me feel really good. I want people to enjoy the experience, because I also, it's hard to find good people. I want to be able to work with them again as well. And I try to let people know when they're doing a good job that they are doing a good job and that I do appreciate it.
So that's a great answer. And, to your point about sort of leading people with inspiration, I get a sense of that, which is great. But obviously, this is a podcast about failure and rejection and adversity. And this is too good. We need to move back to something bad. Right. Otherwise, no one's going to believe this.
Sure. Okay.
So you hinted at it when you said you've been on productions elsewhere where people led by fear. So I obviously don't expect you to name the show, but what's the worst? And this could be at any point in your career, obviously, ideally not one that you ran, because that would be awkward. But what's the worst experience you've had on a show in terms of not a good place to work, not feeling like people can do their best work? And what did you learn from that for when you did become the boss?
The thing that leaps to mind is such an early experience, because it made me think I would never want someone to feel this way. Very early on, I was production assistant, and the DP, we were like, I think, trying to hold gaffing grip equipment, flags on a roof, in Venice, and the wind is blowing, and you're holding, you can't even hold it still. And I just remember somebody senior saying, which one of you guys, meaning us production assistants, there's always one of you guys that's just lower than dirt, just lower than dirt. Which one of you is that? And I just said, that would be me, sir. That would be me. I need you to over here to, menial task they wanted me to do. And that was my way of sort of calling it out, was to own it and go, yeah, that's me. I'm the lowest one. What do you got? And I did it. I was probably holding something even heavier while the wind was blowing on us. And I just thought, I never want to make anybody feel like that. I would never say that. Who's the low? Like, what position are you in? This was like a no budget indie flick. Like, why would you say that? And look, this person might have felt like they were kidding around, and maybe they were, but I just thought, I don't want to make people feel like there's a hierarchy and there's somebody that's the lowest person that has to do the lowest job. I actually have been really appreciative of PAs who went the extra mile or got us a great lunch or whatever, a killer parking spot, whatever it is that makes the day run easier. I would never make somebody assign somebody something because they were the lowest, and to acknowledge that they were the lowest. So that stuck with me.
I thank you. That's a super great candid answer. And sort of on theme with that, was there ever a moment, maybe that was the moment that night, where you were like, Hollywood, which can be the greatest business in the world, can also be the most horrific in some ways. Was there ever a moment where you were like, I'm done, I'm going to be something else, I'm going back to where I'm from and packing up shop?
Yeah, it's probably several. Yeah. I mean, you know, where you just people, you could be made to feel very low. I think again, you know, usually it goes away. I think, you know, if whatever, there's an interaction or a disappointment, either you didn't get a job or a project fell through or somebody made you feel small, it does go away. And I think the trick is if you sort of wake up, maybe not the very next day, but if you wake up and you feel the drive to do it again, or to go out and, you know, tell another story, or, you know, get onto another show, it's kind of the only way, right? And it's sort of like relationship, you know, if it's breakup, you go, oh, well, that's it. I'll never see anybody again. And so it's, and, you know, but eventually, you know, you will. It's just hard to get over at the time.
Thank you. Yes, that's, yeah, exactly. Now, unfortunately, we are at this time of the podcast where it's, you know, we have to ask you the final question that we ask everybody who comes on our podcast. And the question is, if you could give one piece of advice to somebody joining the business, in your case, on the unscripted side, what would it be?
My advice would be to have patience and hang in there, because I thought in the mid-90s, I thought based on my shorts, I was going to have a career as writer, director of features, and that didn't happen. Then I thought I was going to have a career, in front of the camera as a writer, actor in a comedy troupe. That didn't happen. What ended up happening is that when I was finally in a position to direct and produce, I ended up taking all the skills that I had learned along the way as a post-production supervisor. I knew how to mix. I knew color correction. I knew, you know, cameras. I knew editing. I knew all these things. So when I finally had my shot, and it wasn't maybe in the exact spot I thought, I suddenly had this toolbox to draw from. So I'm actually really glad I did not get to make a feature in the mid-90s, because I don't think I would still be talking to you today. I think I might have gotten to do one or two. And if they didn't do well, then that would be the end of it. So I think it was, for the longevity of my work, really good that I was not given the keys to the city on the first go around. I had to work for it. And then I had a lot of paints in my to use with my paintbrush when I got there.
Very good. I'm trying to think, after 120 something episodes, I'm not sure we've had patience explained like that as an answer, but that is a great answer and a great piece of advice.
Well, thank you. I will say too, because you asked this, you know, about other points, you know, after I had been partnered with Kirby Dick and we had an incredible run of success, I thought it was time for me to go off and direct, you know, on my own. And I had three killer projects. They were sure to go, and none of them went. And so I had to sort of, you know, start over or rebuild myself. And you know, and at the time it seems bleak, but eventually comes around. Not those projects, but other ones. So there is always something else. It's something actually, a DP, a cinematographer that I've worked with very closely, had said to me at one point when I was despairing over something didn't come through. And she said, well, you know that something else always comes along. And I said, does it? And she said, yeah, of course. Look how long you've been doing this. And so from that point forward, and she probably said that to me, oh, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago, I've always thought, oh yeah, something else always comes along. And it does.
Very good. Well, Eddie Schmidt, thank you very much for coming on the show. And we hope the thing that comes along next is the elusive award that you deserve to win after all these nominations. But thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, brought to you by Scriptation. Thank you, as ever, to James Launch for the music, and thank you to our loyal listeners. And if there's any showrunners out there who want to hear their fellow showrunners abused and ruffled around and put under the microscope so you can hear their stories of rejection, failure, and adversity, please send them our way.
If you are interested in following us on social media, no, I've lost track.
I am at Ann Ebslin on Twitter or X or whatever Elon Musk now calls it. And thanks to Elon Musk, I'm also at Noah Ebslin on Hive, Spoutable, Blue Sky, Threads, Mastodon, MySpace, Friendster, and I'm sure a thousand more.